Okay. So, has everybody looked at the project 4 description? Right? And that's basically asking you to do this. Okay? And then I have provided code. I have provided code. For some reason, this thing doesn't work. So let me see. So I have provided code at the bottom for doing unification already. So the code is in the bottom. You just have to cut it from here and paste it. Okay. And then I also provided code for you to do ground theorem proving. Okay. And then basically what you need to do is convert it into variableized theorem proving. So first order theorem proving. And for that, you need to use my unification algorithm, my unification procedure, and then essentially keep track of the substitutions. And then whenever you get substitution for one conjunct, you have to push it into the rest of the conjuncts. Okay? That's the part that we were talking about last time as the sideways information passing. That's basically sideways information passing. So in this particular case, if you remember what we were doing last time, and that's all said, I mean, I tried to do it. I'm not sure whether I did it on the board or not, but this is also there, okay? So if you have your knowledge base here, and you're trying to prove apartment pet exists, okay? Now, normally, it's an existential query, okay, and you when you actually convert it, it becomes there doesn't exist an apartment pet, and you're trying to refute it by showing apartment pets. That's the basic idea. Okay? And the way you do it is you start taking the goal that you have on your hand and then start from top of the knowledge base, top of your database, come down, look for the first thing whose head unifies with what you're trying to prove. Okay? And once you, for example, in this particular case, this one unifies with apt pet x if you set x equal to x dash. So by the way, the idea is you always, whenever you use a rule, you assume implicitly, whenever you take the rule from the database, you standardize the variables apart. The second time you take it, you again standardize the variables apart. So that means you always, if it's a rule about x, then you make it x1 this time, next time x2, next time x3, and so on, okay? So that there is no way two different variables wind up having the same name when they don't have to, okay? So what I did when I took this was I essentially made this small x dash and pet x dash implies apartment pet x dash. And then apartment pet x dash and apartment pet x can be unified if I set x equal to x dash. Can be unified if I set x equal to x dash. It's working. And then at that point you have to work on your tail of that rule. The tail of the rule is small x dash and pet x dash. Okay. But then, I have to work on small x dash and pet x dash. And the way you work, whenever you have a conjunction, whether it is at the top level or the bottom level, whenever you have a conjunction, you work on them left to right. That's the convention. Okay? So you work on small x dash, and then you look for the first thing that will unify with small xness. Okay? In this particular case, small x implies skunk x. I'm sorry, skunk x implies small x. So let's assume you take this out and said, when you took it out of the database, you said skunk x double dash implies small x double dash. So you standardize the variables apart again. At this point, with x dash substituted for x double dash, this will essentially unify exactly with what it is that you're trying to prove, small x dash. And so then you get to sub-goal. In fact, what you're doing here can be thought of as sub-goaling. Okay? And so here you're trying to prove this theorem, and you now have to prove two sub-theorems. If you prove those two, then you have proved the top one. Okay? But it's sort of like a search tree, except it's an AND-OR search tree. Okay? A normal search tree that you have seen in A star search is what's called an OR search tree, in the sense you start from a node and there are multiple options. Okay, and then if you take this option, there are multiple options again. If you take this option, there are multiple options again. Okay, this is called an OR search node. OR search. Okay, what you have there, actually, in essence, what I'm showing you here is obviously apartment pet can be proved ultimately by multiple ways. In this particular case, there's only one rule. Okay, but you could potentially have had multiple rules whose head happens to be apartment pet X, in which case you could have had multiple ways of proving that. They're all R branches. For each branch you take, then you would actually have to work on, let's say in this case, two sub-goals together. And it's not a choice. You have to work on both of them. Okay, so the tree that you have would look more like this. You start with the theorem, and then either you can go this way or this way or this way. If you go this way, then you would have to work on these two, okay? And if you go this way, you have to work on these three. And if you go this way, you just have to work on one thing, okay? And then if you come here, then there are again this way or this way. And then if you go this way, there are two things and so on. So what you really have is an AND OR tree. And a solution in an R tree is a path. Right? A solution in an R tree is a path from root to the leaf node. Okay? A solution in the AND OR tree, on the other hand, is a subtree, which is just all AND. Okay, so for example, a solution could be something like this. I will try to work on this. I'll take these two. And then in here, I'll take this, and this, this, okay? And then this one, let's assume it's already true. So that would be an AND tree. It basically proved all the theorems. So in essence, what your program is doing is it has an implicit AND OR tree in front of it, and it's navigating it to find an AND subtree that corresponds to a solution. Okay? And, you know, in fact, this kind of a view is very useful. AND-OR subtrees are very useful in many cases. AND-OR graphs are very useful in many cases. One particular use is problem reduction search. Okay? So you have a big problem. You can do it by either splitting it into these two subproblems, or these three subproblems, or this one subproblem. Now these two subproblems, if you split it, you have to work on both of them. And for each subproblem, there are multiple ways of doing it again. Okay? And really, the theorem proving is a problem reduction search. You have a big theorem to prove, okay? And you're trying to prove it by saying, well, if I can prove this lemma and this lemma, then I have proved the theorem. If that doesn't work, there may be other two or three or lemmas that I have to prove, all of them, and then again, I'll be proving the theorem. Okay? That's what you're doing. Okay, so after the small, then, you know, you come here, you got conk x double dash, and now you have to look for something which unifies with skunk. Notice that when I came here, when I came in the beginning, then I'm looking for apartment pet. In essence, the way I would be calling my theorem, if you look at the code, is the theorem is called with, theorem proof is in essence, I forget what I called it, the specific function name. It's being called with the theorem to be proved and list of facts, list of axioms. Okay? And then one of the interesting things is that when the first one was called, it started at the full list of axioms. Okay, but then the very first one wound up unifying. Okay, so then what it does in essence is it essentially calls, you know, without coming out of this, it calls itself recursively theorem prove now on the small and pet. with the full list of axioms. Okay? Now, if it turns out that this particular recursion fails and comes back up to the parents and saying, I can't live, then the parent continues with the next part of the list. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it will look to see if it has already seen up to here, if there is one more rule below which would unify with apartment, pet, nest, it will just use that. If not, it too would fail and go to its parent. And if the very first theorem fails, then the theorem cannot be proved. So it's a theorem is calling, theorem is calling, theorem is calling, theorem. Okay. So if you do a trace on the main program, you can nicely see the subcalls going through. Okay? So that also shows that when you came to small, the first small that worked is this. But that particular theorem still keeps, it basically says, okay, this small is working, so I will work on proving skunkness and then see if I can prove the whole thing through that. Okay? If not, if I fail and come here, then I'll just go down right from here looking for another axiom which says I can prove you smallness. Okay, so that's actually what happened here, because you came to skunk, and then the skunk essentially, you tried to prove skunk by, axiom 9, which says, well, if Louis is x double dash, then you have a skunk. But the moment you said x double dash is Louis, then the other parts, remember there were these other lemmas that have to be proved. They all have to be proved for the same bindings. So you have to make sure that the binding you put here is passed on to this. That's not too hard, because what actually happens is when you call theorem prove with small and pet, the way the program works is it first calls theorem prove on small, takes the binding, puts it into pet, and then calls that pet. That's the way the program works. Okay? So when it came here now, that binding basically is x double dash is Louis, but then x dash is x double dash, so which means x dash is Louis. Okay? And to do that, essentially, you have this notion of composition of substitution list, of unifiers. So if I have x dash to x double dash composed with x double dash to Louis, I get x dash to Louis and x double dash to Louis. The obvious thing. Which can then be, and now of course any sentence, any other sub-theorems, now you have to make these substitutions into those theorems before you prove them. And so that's what you try to do. You try to prove petness of Louis. And then unfortunately, you could not prove petness of Louis, because the way to prove petness, here is an interesting thing. To prove pet, you can prove that it's a dog. That fails. And then you try, go little below, and try to prove it using cat. That too fails. Then you go one more level, and you try to prove it's an elephant. That too fails. Now at this point, you are unable to prove petness. So now, chronologically, so here it looks as if you're going sideways, but if you look at your recursion stack, right, so you called here, which then called, and then called this. So all you're doing is you're unpopping the stack, and the next recursion on top of you would be this. Okay? Then you try to see, maybe Louis is not a good pet, but maybe somebody else who happens to be a skunk is also a pet. There could be bad skunks and good skunks. Maybe this could be a bad skunk. Okay? So then all you do is you try to prove there is a way of proving skunkness using some other binding for Louis. In this case, there are no other skunks. If there were, you would have tried them. Okay? Since that too fails, then you go here and you try to prove smallness in a different way. And this time, you were proving smallness using this theorem. Next, you try to prove it using catness. And then the catness basically, so the cat theorem will be satisfied first time for Garfield. And then you substitute that here, you are trying to prove Garfield can be a pet. Okay, and then it so happens that to prove pet, you can be a cat. The first version fails because it tries to prove that Garfield is a pet because it's a dog. That fails. Then you try to prove Garfield is a pet because it's a cat. That you will succeed. At which point you finally say, I have a theorem. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what you wind up, that's what your theorem prover winds up doing. It looks as if it's a very simple idea. It's a small enough database that you can see, you know, for yourself what the answer is. But, you know, the way the search works is it's basically systematically trying out all possibilities. Okay? So that's basically, you know, making this happen is what your project to code is. And the interesting thing about it is that if you do that, then you can write pretty reasonably complex looking first order logic assertions. All of them are definite clauses. Okay? If you write all sorts of definite clauses, then you can prove, you know, theorems on the definite clauses. Okay? And then, of course, the interesting thing is this is more or less how Prolog works. With some bells and whistles, this is exactly how Prolog works. Okay, so if you ever used Prolog and wondered how is that working, then this is what it does. So in a way, you are writing your own little Prolog interpreter for this project. Okay? Yes?
If we have our disjunct on the left hand side, we just break it up into two.
What?
Like, it's small x or pet x, like apartment pet x, if it was like that.
This small, okay, so first of all, you won't be able to write it, you won't be able to write it that way. So then, the way you would write small x or pet x implies apartment pet x, this is, instead of writing this, you would basically, this is exactly equal to small x implies apt and pet x implies apt. Disjunction on the antecedent is okay. Disjunction on the consequent, you die. Because the moment you say disjunction on the consequent, then it's no longer a Hund clause. And if it's not a Hund clause, it's not a definite clause. Okay, so the nice thing about this theorem prover is that it not only proves a theorem, but it also actually gives you the identity of the object for which the theorem is satisfied. Okay, such proofs are called what proofs? In fact, how many of you have done theory of computer science? 355. How come you didn't do 355 and you are in my class? So 355, you would have basically learned lots and lots of theorems, right? But most of the theorems, the proof of the theorem involves actually constructing the object that proves the theorem. And such proofs are called constructive proofs. Such proofs are constructive proofs. Okay? And this basically, what we are saying is that in fact, Prolog style theorem provers are actually, Hund clause theorem provers are actually quite well placed, well positioned to construct all the constructive theorems, constructive proofs. Okay, since I said constructive proofs, let's talk about a proof that's not constructive. What would be a proof? What's a proof that's not constructive called? Okay, here is a proof I'm going to give you right now. My proposition is, are there irrational numbers P and Q such that P power Q is rational? That's what I'm interested in doing. Now, you could prove a constructive, you can provide a constructive proof for this. You can provide probably some other kind of proof for it. I will give you a different kind of a proof. Consider square root of 2. All of you agree it's irrational, right? Okay? Let's consider square root of 2 power square root of 2. Okay? Now, I don't know whether it's irrational or rational. It can only be one of them. That's a nice thing, right? All numbers have to be, you know, we know that this does not get you into imaginary numbers, right? So square root of 2, power square root of 2 has to be either rational or irrational, okay? Let's assume it is rational. then done. P is root 2, Q is root 2. I have proved the theorem. In fact, it is true, such things do exist. Now suppose it's not rational, that means it's irrational. Then I would say P is root 2 power root 2 and Q is root 2. Why is that interesting? Because root 2 power root 2 power root 2 is nothing but root 2 square, which is 2. Right? So I have basically said, well, look, it has to be either rational or irrational. If it's rational, you're done. If it's irrational, you're done. So I have proved that there do exist numbers, P and Q, such that P and Q are irrational and P power Q is rational. I proved it to you. Now, can you tell me such numbers? Can you tell me a P and Q such that, in fact, P power Q and P and Q are actually rational and P power Q is rational? I didn't tell you. This theorem, I proved the theorem without telling you what those numbers are. Okay? These are called existential proofs. Okay? The interesting thing, of course, is can this kind of analysis get you existential proofs? No. Actually, you can see why this proof could not have been constructed by this guy. What's interesting about this proof? There's a case analysis going on. It's either this or this. If it is this, I prove you. If it is this, I also prove you. So I prove. But I don't quite know which is the real case. Okay? Without even knowing, I've actually proved the theorem. And such theorems cannot be proved using Hahn-Clausewitz theorem provers. But you have seen these kinds of theorems, right, in life. And in fact, for those of you who have never heard about existential proofs, and I hope, or maybe just heard it in passing, existential proofs are like extremely important for existence of mathematics in general. Okay, for a while, people in mathematics tried to argue that you should rid all mathematics of all non-constructive proofs. Okay. All mathematics of all non-constructive proofs, because you know, if you can't show me an object that has the property that you're saying, you know, what good is the proof? Okay, but then if that happened, then we would have been in big trouble because half of mathematics will go out the window. So it's sort of like saying, only tell me stuff that I can understand. You know, even if the other things are true, I don't want to hear about it. Okay, so in fact, existential proofs are put back into math, and they are very much par for the course. Okay, sometimes for these kinds of things you can provide both existential and constructive proofs, but there are also theorems in the world for which we currently only have existential proofs. Okay, and that's a proof still. And the interesting point about that is that these proofs cannot be captured by this, and that's why you need resolution. This is generalized modus ponens. The last time around we talked about case analysis was in propositional logic, where we said that you can have the resolution can do case analysis and in the theorem itself, okay, where modus ponens cannot. Do you understand what I'm saying? Make sure you understand what I just said. It's not so much in going through the search tree, it looked as if generalized modus ponens is constructing different lines of proof to see which would work. That looks like it's looking at cases too, right? It's looking, okay, this proof works, this proof doesn't work, let me try another proof. That doesn't work, let me try another proof. But in the end, when it is done, it actually has a constructive proof. There is no case analysis in that single proof itself. Here, the single proof, this whole thing is a proof. I cannot show you just this and say, look, I proved the theorem. Or I can't show you just this and say, I proved the theorem. I have to show you both. Then I proved the theorem. So the proof itself has disjunction, essentially. It has case analysis. And, you know, that's what resolution is able to do, modus ponens is unable to do. And that's when you get completeness. Okay, so before we get to resolution, and you know, when you get to resolution, you know you have to convert everything into classal form, and then you do all this nice resolution stuff, you know, the way you did for proposition logic, except you'll do it for first order logic now. Okay, but before we get there, let's just point out a couple of things about backward chaining. On one hand, backward chaining inference is essentially going to get you sound results. Anything that it proves are actually entailed in a model theoretic sense. On the other hand, obviously, if your knowledge base is currently not in definite clause form, then there are theorems that follow from the knowledge base that cannot be proven by you. Okay, that's the theoretical part. On top of that, because of the way you tend to implement the search, because of the way you tend to implement search, okay, there is another issue that comes up, which is sort of an implementational incompleteness. For example, let's say I said cat X implies pet X, and then right below it I said pet X implies cat X. Then what happens to your theorem prover? You'll come running to prove petness using catness, and then it'll start all over again and try to prove catness using petness, start all over again, prove petness using catness. So the sub-goals wind up basically, I mean, you get, in proving P, you get Q as a sub-goal, which gets P as a sub-goal, which gets Q back as a sub-goal. Now you know that if ever you're trying to prove something big, and then after 15,000 steps you're trying to, a sub-goal happens to be the thing that you're trying to prove, if nothing else, you know that path isn't leading you anywhere. If you cut that path and go up, you still won't lose completeness. There cannot be, if something can be proved, then it should be possible to prove it without calling itself as a sub-goal. Okay, so this is actually a problem. This is actually a problem in the program that you will write. And how do you stop this kind of infinite recursion from happening? There are a couple of things you can do. You can keep track of the sub-goals on the stack and see whether what I am about to prove is essentially the same as what I wanted to prove. Do you understand what I'm saying? And if so, then you cut that path. That's basically cycling. This is equivalent to finding duplicate nodes during a star search. In trying to prove a theorem, in this particular case, in trying to prove pet, I got cat. Cat right away got me to pet. But I can always do all sorts of other interesting things. Catness implies petness. And so if you try to prove pet, you need to prove cat. And there is a J-ness, which implies catness, and there is a Q-ness, which implies J-ness. There is an M-ness, which implies Q-ness. You know where I'm going with this, right? And then I finally say, well, by the way, you can always prove Q-ness by proving catness. I'm sorry. Let's say no. M-ness implies Q-ness, and catness implies M-ness. So it looked as if you're going in a pretty nice direction. After a while, you suddenly found that what you're trying to prove became a sub-goal of it. This happens all the time to you guys in trying to prove things to yourself. This is exactly like what we said can happen in a star search too, right? And that's where what we did was we kept track of the list of, the simple thing we could do was to keep track of all the ancestors on the current path and see if the node is duplicate of any of the ancestors. Then you kill it, and that would be soundness preserving. You know that by doing, I mean, completeness preserving. That means by doing it, you won't lose, you won't be unable to prove any theorem that can be proved. So that's something that you can do on your program too. Okay, or you can of course also try and put a simpler issue, which is if you don't feel like doing this check of whether this goal is present on the stack. You can also do just a simple depth-limited depth-first search, which is you keep a, whenever, you know, the recursion calls itself, it increments the depth level. and you might say that the total depth that you go to should not be more than 200. That means I will refuse to find any proofs which are deeper than 200 levels. And to the extent most of your proofs are likely to be less than 200, the few times you will cross it would be because of this kind of nonsense, and so you will kill it. That's a very easy thing to do, but a much smarter thing to do is to fix by checking current goal against every goal on the stack. There was a question. Okay. And then basically, there is also this issue of some sub-goals might be repeatedly evaluated. Okay, but that's, you can't change that. That's not, I mean, you can do it by caching previous results. Anytime you prove a theorem, go ahead and add it to the list of things that are true. So for example, if you ever proved, if you just proved to yourself that Garfield is a pet, just go ahead and add it to the database so that if anybody else wants to prove that Garfield is a pet, they will use that right away and stop going and reproving the theorem. That's another cute way of improving speed. Of course, this increases the amount of stuff that you're storing. But this is a good way of learning. Anytime you prove a theorem, you remember how you say, oh, that theorem is proved now, I don't need to do it again. And in fact, if you have proved a theorem, then you don't need to reprove it again. And in fact, how many of you, did I already tell you guys the mathematician proving, dealing with a room on fire? Okay, so I can tell you that. So that's basically proving, reducing something to something that's already proved, so you don't need to prove it again. Okay, so the mathematician was sleeping, and there was like a fire next to him. Basically suddenly he found that, he left a cigarette or something, and light is on fire or something. So he wakes up, he realizes there's a fire, so he needs to put out the fire. It's a small fire, thankfully. So there's an empty glass, so he walks all the way to the bathroom, fills it up with water, comes back, pours it on the fire, and goes to sleep. That's good. Couple of days later, the same thing happened, except there's a small difference. This time, the glass was full of water. So he pours the water onto the floor and says, now I have reduced it to a problem that's already been solved, and goes back to sleep. Right? So essentially, never ever waste your deliberative effort. That's what he did. Okay? So he proved the theorem previously by and so now I know how to deal with the empty glass scenario, so I'll make the empty glass happen, and then he'll take care of it. Anyway, but in general, remembering, proved theorems is always a useful thing to do. But there is some trade-off, storage versus use trade-off. Okay, so Prolog more or less works this way, and that's basically something that I pointed out. And one other thing that Prolog does, the Prolog actually in fact has a couple of other things over and above. So which of you would be able to tell me, how many of you have realized that it can't be the case that Prolog works exactly this way? There is a sanity check, right? This is not even a general purpose programming language, because there are theorems that would be true that this guy can't prove. Prolog is a general purpose programming language. So if this is what Prolog is doing, it can't be a general purpose programming language. It can't be Turing complete. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's just sanity check. You can't, I understand this must be the way Prolog works, but it must be doing something a little more, because otherwise, how is it going from incomplete to fully expressive programming language? The things that Prolog does, of course, essentially, is when it writes these kinds of theorems, the axioms I wrote, it normally writes it head, if, literal 1, literal 2, etc., right? Okay, and in fact, in Prolog, it always does go from top to bottom, looking for heads that can be unified. And when it tries to, if it unifies the head, then it sub-goals on the literals in the order. However, Prolog also has these things like cut operator. How many of you actually know Prolog? Okay, 240. You are supposed to have heard about Prolog, so somebody should be sued. But Prolog basically uses the cut operator, which is Prolog's way of getting into the middle of this search and telling the search what to do. I'm not going to explain to you how cut operator works, but those of you who understand Prolog will realize that cut operator is the way Prolog sort of controls the search. Which actually, if you think about it, sort of nonsensical. Because the normal reason why people say logic programming, such as Prolog, is a great idea, is because in a normal programming, you do identify the problem, you assemble information, you figure out the solution, you program the solution, you encode the problem instance as data, you apply the program to the data, you debug, and then you're done. And logic programming guys, in general, basically, try to tell you that, well, you know, if you find a problem, and you assemble the information, and then while other people are trying to figure out the solution, you take a tea break. Because you don't need to figure out the solution. Right? Because your program, if you have a problem, you just here, for example, I didn't tell this guy how to find apartment pets. I just told it what I know about petness and apartment petness and smallness, etc. Just declarative information. Right? So while your friends would be actually desperately trying to figure out how to prove something, you just write this down and give it to your Prolog interpreter. Right? And then of course, you know, you take a deep break and then you just encode it into a knowledge base and then encode the problem instance as facts and ask the queries. And Prolog will do it. A logic programming underneath will do the actual theorem proving. Okay, this is not the only place where this happens. In general, there are other kinds of high-level programming languages, such as, for example, you know, converting any problem you like into an integer programming problem. So you write it down as a bunch of integer programming constraints, and then you don't need to figure out how to solve it. You give it to Cplex, which is an integer programming solver. Or you can write it as a constraint programming, which is sort of close to CSP ideas that you talked about. Okay, and then you wrote project 2 code and you didn't particularly appreciate that you had to write it. But really, all you need to do is you write what you know as CSP constraints, and the CSP solver, you know, if one set of people have implemented a very good CSP solver, that can be used for anybody's CSP problem. So that's basically the appeal of what are called declarative programming paradigms. Where you just tell the substrate what you know about the problem in a form it can understand. You know, each of the, you know, logic programming solvers understand Hahn clauses. Integer programming solvers understand linear and integer constraints. A nonlinear programming solver could also understand nonlinear constraints. So all you do in trying to use integer programming essentially is think of your problem and think of what would be the constraints. If that are satisfied, the problem will have a solution. And if you're doing the CSP, the same thing. And then once you write them down, you don't need to solve them yourself. The solver would solve them. Okay? Now, the problem, of course, is that's the good thing. The bad thing, of course, is every solver starts probably with some inbuilt search process. Okay? And if that is the case, then that particular search process may not be the best search process for your problem. It might take forever to solve your problem. And there should be probably problem-specific efficiency improvements you should do for the search. And your friend who never saw a high-level programming language would be writing happily a C program and would have basically put in all the problem-specific information into their program, and theirs will work fine, yours will be somewhat slower. Okay, and so now there are two issues. Issue one is how do you deal with it? And so the fact is that search, underlying search, can depend upon the problem, and who is going to deal with the efficiency issue? Okay, I don't care about efficiency. Okay, I'll just give it and then I'll go home and take multiple tea breaks, sleep and come back, and if it's done, that's okay. Okay, but if you have a boss, they might care. And then, so you're trying to tell your boss, the worst that can happen to you is boss asking, you know, yeah, all this nonsensical high-level programming languages, why don't you work in C? Or maybe assembly language, you know, and at least that way you don't need to, I'm already paying for your time, okay? So the question is, what are you going to tell your boss? and you want to be able to use the high-level language, that what you can tell immediately to your boss is, look, Prolog actually provides me a way of controlling the search. Okay, but that's kind of weird, because on one hand I'm saying, you know, you can forget about how to solve the problem, just give me the facts. But then, since I'm anyway going to solve it in a particular way, and if you don't think that particular way would be good, put reasonable number of cut operators here and there to tell me how to do my search. Which is quite hard. You know, it's sometimes, you know, I don't know whether any of you tried to explain to somebody how to solve a problem, as against doing it yourself. And then oftentimes, you know, you find like, you know, to heck with you, you know, I'll do it myself. Just let me take it and then I'll do it. You know, not too long ago, a colleague of mine was next to me, and you know, we are in Phoenix and we don't do parallel parking, right? And why the heck do we have to do parallel parking, right? So I don't understand how to do parallel parking. And so he was trying to explain to me in Washington, D.C. how to do parallel parking, and he was trying to say, do this, etc. And after a while, he said, to heck with it, and he just started, you know, steering. So that was his way of telling me, you know, instead of trying to get my mind to understand, in knowing how my mind works, you know, getting my mind to understand how to do the parallel parking, it was easier for him to do it himself. Okay, and that's sort of what happens when you're trying to put cut operations. At some point of time, you would start thinking, if there are too many cut operators to have to be put, A, the program that comes out would be quite hard to understand, because it's no longer declarative. It's combining declarative and procedural control. And B, at some point of time, you might think, I could have written this in C. Why should I have to, you know, go through this so-called higher level language and then think of how it does search and then tell it how to not do it that way? And depending upon which way you work, you would either love Prolog or you hate Prolog. You understand what I'm saying? So that's basically the issue that I'm trying to bring in here, that there is a dream, I mean, there is this ideal thing, which is that you don't need to think about control, but on the other hand, my specific search is not necessarily right for your problem. But, you know, if you don't have to answer your boss right away, then there is a beautiful, computer science research program here, which is construct another system, which takes a Prolog program, and which knows about how the Prolog engine works, and then optimizes the Prolog program so that it will run faster on the Prolog engine. How many of you have heard about optimizing compilers? What do you think they're doing? They're doing exactly this. Okay? And it's a beautiful computer science research direction. However, you don't get to tell your boss, especially if you are like just joined the job, that, yeah, I can deal with it. Give me 5-6 years, I'll do a nice research program and, you know, figure this out. So there are like two different answers. One is, if your life depends on it right now, you have to use cut operators. On the other hand, declarative programming isn't a bad idea at all. It might work very well for most of the cases. And then you can develop systems which can take a declarative program and then do problem-specific optimizations to it. As long as the humans aren't doing it, that's very good. That's what you're, you know, taking the CS course for, as against just doing, you know, some programming course. Okay, so that's the basic point where we actually come out of just Prolog. If this is sort of true, whatever I just said is true for any declarative programming paradigm. This is logic programming, you can have integer programming, you can have constraint programming. And wherever you have X programming, what that means is all you know about the world, write it in the X form. And then there is an engine which runs it. Right now, all you are doing is Intel programming. Not integer programming, but Intel programming, because most of you are winding up writing Intel assembly code. And there is an engine which works with Intel assembly code. And the question, of course, is if the constraints that your problem has are much higher level, then these guys are supporting them directly. Okay, question. Okay, one other thing that Prolog does, is basically that Prolog has inbuilt negation as failure, which means that if it's unable to prove something, it assumes the negation of the theorem is true. Do you understand what I'm saying? And that is actually The moment you allow negation as failure, you can support non-monotonic reasoning. Why? Because, you know, suppose you're trying to prove, whether not P is true. So then what you try to do is you try to prove P. You're unable to prove P, and that's, so you'll just go ahead and assume, yeah, not P is true. So you now have put not P as a theorem. Now I'll go ahead and add P to the database. I just gave you extra information. In monotonic logic, when you get extra information, every theorem that you proved before is still a theorem. But the moment I added P, unless you're dumb and don't know how to actually prove, right, you would not be able to prove P. So you no longer are able to prove not P. So this not P is no longer a theorem. It's out of the thing. So in fact, you know, with closed world assumption, with basically negation as failure inbuilt, Prolog is able to support non-monotonic reasoning. Okay. Now, of course, providing semantics for negation as failure is a huge deal. We won't talk about it. But implementing negation as failure in Prolog is extremely easy. Implementing negation as failure in your project is extremely easy. All you do is, you'll only do it when you're trying to prove not P. So any negated theorem. To do that, so not of P will be proved by subgoaling and proving P. If that thing comes and says yes, then here, this is, you know, this cannot be proved. If it says no, then this is proved. Okay? And the reason it's also called closed world assumption is that you are saying every way of proving P is already known. And since I'm unable to find a proof for P, that means essentially not P is true. Okay? And that basically, the negation as failure is one of the extra credit portions. As is, you know, cutting down the looping is also an extra credit portion. Okay, so you can do all of those if you're interested. Okay? So, resolution. Yes, sir.
Does that mean that if we have negation as failure, anytime a new fact is added to a database, we need to revise our theorem?
Yeah. But then, you know, so what happens is, you know, negation as failure, building a negation as failure winds up, where am I? Yeah. Doing negation as failure here winds up having problems with caching previous results. Right? If you proved a theorem and you cached it, then you no longer can do it. If you're a monotonic logic, you can cache theorems. If you're a non-monotonic logic, it cannot be cached. Okay? Okay, so any other questions on this stuff? If not, we are going to do resolution, and then that would basically be enough for you to complete the homework, which is due next week. Okay, so all you need to do in resolution is everything you know already. You know about unification. The only thing you need to do is have stuff in a causal form. Okay, and then if you have two clauses, and if one of the literals from one of the clauses unifies with another of the literals from another of the clauses, and one literal is in negated form, one is in the positive form, then you can remove both of them and put the other guys together as disjunction. And unification is a more general case of equality, right? Anything that's equal is already unified. Okay? Fine. So, now the assumption, of course, is if I have not rich X or unhappy X and rich can, then I can essentially resolve these two by unifying X to can, in which case I can remove both of these. I'll only have unhappy X, except X is can. So I get to write unhappy can. Right? That's basically what I need to do. So the only magic I need to explain to you, everything you know in this, the only magic I need to explain to you is, given any arbitrary logical, first order logic sentence, how do I get it to this form? The interesting thing about this form is, first of all, you have variables and no quantifiers. What happened to the quantifiers? We got rid of them. And in some sense, we got rid of them. But you know, in basically what I'm saying is, whenever there's a variable, assume that it is universally quantified. That's what you are saying. Now, of course, there would have been some variables that were existentially quantified. What did you do to them? You did skolemization that we discussed last class. Remember Jessica Alba thing? So you need to put the skolemization based on an existential variable is replaced by a skolem function of all the for all variables under whose scope this existential occurs. So if I said for all x, for all y, for all z, there exists w such that happy w, then basically what I'm supposed to do is I can replace this w by saying happy some column function sk009 of x, y, z. I didn't tell you what that function is. There is such a function. It depends on x, x, y, and z. Now, when I say a function depends on x, y, and z, it can also basically take x, y, and z, ignore them, and give a number out. That's okay. Right? And f of x can be a constant that doesn't care about x. Okay? The point, of course, is by writing this, I'm also allowing the possibility that the function does depend upon the variable. Okay, so the difference between this and a statement which says there exists x, happy x, that would be changed as happy of sk 0010 of nothing, because there is no for all quantifier beyond this. So you know, in this case, this is a function of zero variables. What is a function of zero variables? A constant. In this case, it is a function of three variables, but depending upon your world, it may well be a constant, but it allows it to be non-constant. It can actually depend upon x, y, and z. That's skolemization. Okay? And so all the existential variables disappeared because of skolemization. Okay? So that's what we're going to show you. And everything else you know how to do. You basically get rid of implications, and then you move in the negations. And then when you are moving in negations, one thing that is useful is if I have a negation of for all x p of x and I need to move the negation in, then it becomes there exists x not of p of x. That is something that I told you, right? Whenever a negation walks over a quantifier, it flips it from for all to there exists, or there exists to for all. Okay? In the end, negations should apply directly to an atom, an atomic sentence. Until then, you keep pushing them in. Okay? So the steps for converting any arbitrary first-order logic sentence into a conjunctive normal form is basically eliminate biconditionals and implications. Okay, biconditionals are basically if and only if, and implications are just if. All of them can be converted into, you know, disjunctions, right? And then move negation inwards, keeping in mind that for all x, negation of for all x p will become there exists x not p. And similarly, not of there exists x p will become for all x not p. And everything else, you know, if you have not of a and b, it will become not of a or not of b, which is actually what is happening here. For all basically is a huge big conjunction. When you took the negation in, it became a huge big disjunction. Okay? And then you standardize variables, make sure that no variables, you know, are having the same name, because before basically there was a large sentence and there were multiple quantifiers, all of which are saying for all x, but by the context you know which x is being discussed where. So you make sure that each quantifier has a different variable name. Okay? Now you do the skolemization. At this point, every existential variable would now be replaced by a function, a skolem function of all the universally quantified variables which in whose scope it falls. Okay? So for example, if I started by, you know, suppose I started with this statement, for all x, the following property. For all x, if the following is true, which is for all y, animal y implies loves x, y is true, then there exists y such that loves y x. That's what that sentence was saying. And then when I did the first step, I became this. When I did the second step, I became this. Okay. And then I did the standardization of variables apart by making sure there are no variable on any quantifier, which is repeated. At this point, essentially, there exists y, animal y is falling in the scope of for all x. So I can remove y and put f of x. F is a brand new function. It could have been fk, you know, a function name, which doesn't exist currently in the database. Okay? And then similarly, of course, since I removed it this way, then the same thing has to be put there too. It's the same y. Okay? And now this z is a different existential, but it too falls in the scope of x. So this could be, I'm sorry, this z. And so this z can actually be again a function, but it doesn't have to be this function anymore. It can be a different function of x, g of x. I'm just making names up. Do you understand what I'm saying? And then once I do that, now at this point, I've already dropped the existentials. They're gone. Now I go ahead and drop the universals, because I know that any variables left are implicitly universally quantified. Right? Okay. Then now I do the other operations, distribution again, you know, AND over R, so that I can get a bunch of clauses. So now I have everything in the causal form, and I can do resolution refutation theorem proving. Okay? Let's see some examples. So here is a little example. Everyone is loved by someone. If X loves Y, X will give a Valentine card to Y. Will anyone give Rao a Valentine card? Okay? Not really very important right now. There is no Valentine's Day coming up, but still, that's what get it. Okay? So I can write this, for all X, there exists Y, loves Y, X is this. That's what that sentence is. If I convert into a causal form, it becomes loves SK X dash X dash. Would you agree? SK is a brand new function I made up. If X loves Y, then X will give a Valentine card to Y. Okay? For all X, for all Y, loves Y X implies gives Valentine's card Y X, which can be converted into a causal form, not loves Y X or GV Y X. Now I want to ask, will anyone give Rao a Valentine's card? So my query is, there exists Z such that Z will give Rao Valentine's card. And since I want to prove it by refutation, I'll assume such a thing doesn't exist. So I would put a not of there exists Z, G V Z Rao, and then convert into causal form. You understand what I'm saying? If I did not do this, and if I tried to convert into causal form here, I would have put a column variable here, and you would have been in big trouble. At least I would be. I'll see in a minute. Okay. So in this particular case, you first convert. You know, basically, what you're adding to the database is a negation of what you're trying to prove. So you negate it, and then convert into the causal form, and I will get this for all z not g v z Rao, which is now I can remove this, and it just become not g v z Rao. Now it's the mad chase for the empty clause. Okay? The mad chase for the empty clause ensues, and I just say, well, okay, there is a not GVZ Rao here, there's a GVYX here, so I can make this and this equal by making Y equal to Z and X equal to Rao. That's the unifier. If I do that, then I have to substitute the same thing into this, then I will get not loves Z Rao. Okay, now I can resolve this with this. Okay, and I'll say, if I were to put Z to be SK Rao and X dash to be Rao, that's, by the way, if you unify this to this, that's exactly the unifier you'll get. Then these two will become equal, at which point there's nothing left and I get an empty clause. Okay? Which means I have proved the theorem. I have proved the theorem stating that there does exist somebody who gives Rao the Valentine's card. And of course, you're curious as to who that is, okay? And so all you need to figure out is who is this Z for whom the proof went through. Okay, so I went there. So Z actually became, what happened to Z? Y became Z and Z became SK Rao. So Z really is SK Rao, that's all. So I know who it is, it's SK Rao. Which is like, I know who is going to get the A plus in this class, the A plus getting student. You understand what I'm saying? Now you might have thought that is completely useless information, but I was able to prove a theorem. I was able to prove an existential theorem. There do exist people who will give me a card. You may not know who they are, I probably may not know who they are, but they will exist because of the facts I have. That's very much similar to that root 2 thing. And in fact, you can construct the proof that I gave for root 2 power root 2 power root 2 thing as a first order logic proof, which I think is probably one of the, you know, homework problems. If not, you can still do it yourself anyway. Okay? So don't expect miracles. You would not get knowledge out of nowhere. Right? But it will still tell you that you cannot say that nobody will give a card to Ram. Another interesting version of the same thing is this. Okay? So finding where you left the key, okay, using first order logic. So I know, I'm pretty sure that I left the key either at home or in the office. I'm trying to figure out where did I do it. So I asked first order logic my nice query saying, you know, where is my key? And the way you ask query is, there exists X such that at key X. And the theorem will succeed. Okay? How does the theorem will succeed? Basically, so this becomes, if you negate this, it becomes for all X, not at key X. And then that becomes CNF form is not at key X. Okay? So I have not at key X and at key home and at key office. I need to derive an empty class. How do I do that? I just do two resolutions. Right? I just do two resolutions. So I have not at key X and at key home or at key office. I'll do the first resolution by making this equal to this. Okay, which means X is home. Then I will say basically that I will wind up saying, well, at key office. Now, those of you who are doing it under pressure, you might think, hey, I wanted an answer. There looks like something which is an answer at key office, but that's not allowed. You by negating the theorem and adding it to the database, you're now looking for empty class. Not for things that look like answers, right? This is not telling you that the office, the key is in the office, okay? This is only telling you that if the key is not at home, then it's in the office, which is true. Now I can get an empty class by re-resolving these two and say X equal to office, and I get an empty class. I just proved to myself that the key exists. Where does it exist? X, where is X? X is either office or home. Back to the square one. Do you understand what I'm saying? But this is not bad, because if something, suppose you are essentially trying to prove a theorem saying aliens are there because my key no longer exists. They must have stolen it. Okay? There is a better explanation. It's either in the home or in the office. Aliens don't have to be there for your key to disappear. Do you understand what I'm saying? So there is actually a knowledge that you are providing. It's not specific enough for you to tell exactly where it is. And similarly, there was knowledge involved in proving that there do exist two irrational numbers such that, you know, one power the other would be a rational number. That's the beauty of the number system, that you know beforehand that such things would exist. Sometimes you will actually be able to find what those are. Sometimes you won't be. But the theorem is still true. Okay? So that's basically first order logic. Okay? And this was the existential proof that I just pointed out to you. And in general, the two examples I gave you are both existential proofs. But it turns out that I only showed you the things that the other guy can't do. This guy can do everything the other guy can do. Everything that a generalized mod exponent theorem prover can do, first order logic theorem prover with resolution representation can do. But these two are examples of things that generalized mod exponents cannot prove. That's why I showed them to you. So it's not that you will only use these for weird theorems. It can be used for everything. But if you're using them, there is, of course, search issues, because once you're doing it this way, then it's a semi-decidable process. And it's, you know, reasonably hard to actually even control the search. Okay? But so these examples show that resolution representation is powerful enough to model existential proofs. In contrast, generalized mod exponents is only able to model constructive proofs. Okay? And so the difference between GMC and resolution representation, if you want to just take it as a last minute, then, you know, this is a complete one, and so it is semi-decidable. The other one is incomplete. Okay, it cannot prove certain theorems that are actually provable. Okay? And then, of course, you might say, I will convert everything, if my knowledge base is already in definite clause form, then you are lucky. You will be able to prove everything that can be proved using a GMP theorem prover. If not, what do? You have to go with the first order theorem prover. Okay, or just let the GMP theorem prover work on your knowledge base. Some theorems it will prove, some it won't prove. Okay? That's where we'll stop. Next class, we'll actually come and slowly move from first order logic into reasoning about time and planning.